ago, we were just talking about areas of faith. There's an area of teaching is called apologetics. It kind of talks to us about areas of proving that what the gospel says is true. And I've been talking about that for the next couple of weeks. In different areas where maybe it applies to you, and maybe this is an area where you struggle, or maybe this is an area where you need more confidence in your faith, or maybe this is an area where you have a friend who struggles with this, and you don't know how to respond to them. And the first one we're looking at today is whether science disproves faith. Science disproves faith. And maybe you have a friend, or you hear this in the media, and you'll read something, and it troubles you because the scientists are saying this, and they're saying it disproves what the Bible says, and that undercuts my faith, or it's undercutting my friend's faith. So has the rise of modern science shown that faith is really irrational? And it's an important topic. I'm going to start with a quote from C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity. Some of you, I believe, are familiar with it. But Lewis wrote, "Ever since men were able to think, they have been wondering what the universe really is and how it came to be there." Now, quick heads up here, says, "Since men have been able to think." Why does he say just men, since men have been able to think? Because women have always been able to think. He didn't need it. Just a quick heads up here. When Lewis is talking, this is written 70 years ago. So a little bit, his words are a little bit dated, so I don't want to throw you off on this main point on basic argument for faith. He goes on to write, and very roughly, two views have been held. First, there is what's called the materialist view. People who take that view think that matter and space just happen to exist and always have existed. Nobody knows why, and that the matter, behaving in certain fixed ways, just happened by sort of a fluke to produce creatures like ourselves who are able to think. That's one view, the materialist view. Just a random event, can't be explained, just kind of big giant machine that chugs along. Right, he writes, the other view is the religious view. According to it, what is behind the universe is more like a mind than it is anything else we know. That is to say, it is conscious and it has purposes and it prefers one thing to another. And he also writes, don't think that one of these views is old and one is new. They've been around as long as people can think. So, now in our day, a lot of people are thinking about, has science proven what Lewis called the materialist view is correct? And the universe is a machine, that God does not exist, and the faith is irrational. And I want to look at that today and look at a couple of key issues and key questions. And we're going to be covering some scientific material here, so just some disclaimers up front. I did in school, I'm a major in biology and a minor in chemistry, but I'm not a scientist by trade. I know some of you also have scientific backgrounds and know way more about many branches of science than I'll ever know. But in either case, I'm going to use the thoughts of actual scientists this morning, not just my own thoughts, and as we look at what the Bible has to say. So number one, if you have your little, your bulletin sheets with you, if you don't, they're right outside the door. And if you go to them. Number one, first question is science the only way to reliably know about something? Science has a lot of prestige in our days, and it's a really important question. Are there any other kinds of knowledge besides scientific knowledge? The short answer is, yeah, there's other kinds of knowledge, and if we don't recognize it, it really limits what we have to know to be able to live. A lot of us in school, and some of you in school now, probably remember learning something called the scientific method. Okay, and it's kind of tricky to define exactly, but basically is we make observations about things in our world, and that leads to theories, and then there's going to be a hypothesis to scientists to test that theory, and then we'll do an experiment and we'll be able to measure stuff, and the results will either confirm or deny the hypothesis. Because science has made a lot of progress in certain fields like medicine or technology, some people claim that scientific method or empirical verification is the only way to reliable knowledge, which would, by the way, mean there's no such thing as moral knowledge, there's no such thing as spiritual knowledge, there's no such thing as personal knowledge. But the view that the only knowledge comes from scientific method is sometimes it's called scientism. Not science, but scientism. There's a guy named Sir John Polkinghorne, that's really his name. Sir John Polkinghorne, he's a Cambridge physicist, Anglican priest, He has a really helpful illustration. He says, imagine somebody's asking, why is water boiling in that kettle? And one person that takes the materialist view would say, because burning gas is heating up the water. And another person says, there's water boiling in that kettle because I wanted to make a cup of tea. So which one of them are right? Well, they're both right. One of them takes a materialist view and saying, because the burning gas is under there. And the other one is talking in terms of a person and a purpose and intention. It's not a scientific in a mechanistic way, but it's true, and it's very important to us to recognize. So science involves a mess of this enormously useful to describe reality, but it's not the only way to know truth. For example, human life is of great value. That's true. That's true. We all know that's true, but we can't put that in a test tube. Right? It's not good to live for selfish greed. That's true. That's a moral truth. But that's not something you're going to be able to do an experiment on with a beaker. A society that's unable to recognize the existence of moral truth is headed for serious problems. And there's certain things that we just know are wrong. Rape and child sacrifice and many other things that we all just know are wrong. And yet you can't prove those with a scientific method. So, number one, the circle there, no. Science is not the only way to reliably know about something. All right, ending number two. Has science proven the universe has no purpose? It's just a random machine. And this is a really important thing for us to think about if we're going to be people of faith. And the idea is really rampant in our day. I'm going to give you just the one quote about a guy in the field of science who teaches at Cornell. He says, let me summarize my views on what modern evolutionary biology tells us loud and clear. Now, this is a claim that evolutionary biology has established. There are no gods, no purposes, and no goal-directed forces of any kind. There is no life after death. When I die, I'm absolutely certain I'm going to be dead. There's no ultimate foundation for ethics, no ultimate meaning in life, and no free will for humans, either. Now, by the way, there is no scientific study that will back up anything, that any one of those claims. And yet there's just this idea out there that something has been found out that has discredited faith. Some of you probably remember a guy named Carl Sagan. He had the old show Cosmos, and up there your beings, the beings, stars, the universe. Some of you aren't old enough. Okay, anyway, so there was this show, and basically this is what he wrote. And he did not have a man of faith. He said, we find that we live on an insignificant planet of a humdrum star, lost in a galaxy, tucked away in some forgotten corner of a universe in which there are far more galaxies than people. And notice all these really loaded words, insignificant, humdrum, lost, tucked away, forgotten. And those aren't scientific terms, but they have loaded with meaning. The idea of statements like this is somehow science, by showing the immense size of the universe, you know, that shows that little tiny human beings don't have unique quality or unique dignity or value or worth in the ways that the Bible has taught us. And people have been thinking for a long time about this concept, you know, the contrast between the immensity of nature and the tininess and brevity of human life. Psalmist David said thousands of years ago in Psalm 8, and Andy can next slide, says, when I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have set in place, what is mankind that you are mindful of them? Of human beings that you care for. In fact, we're going to be singing those words in a moment. But it's precisely the same contrast was the object of real serious reflection a long time ago. The psalmist does not go on to say, David does not go on to say, you know, the way to settle this is to look at scales of stuff in terms of physical size. I think people are huge. I think the earth is huge, and the sun and moon and stars are tiny, so we win. Right? That's not what the psalm says. The psalm goes on to say, and I think we can go one more. It says, yet God, you have created human beings with glory and honor. You've crowned them, made them something like transcendent beings. Human beings are given a divine image, and we have this capacity to learn and create, and this is the importance that comes along with being a moral being, being able to make decisions and being responsible for them, being able to take care of creation. And that's why we respond to people the way we do when we see them.
see here. Raise your hand if you have grandchildren. Okay. All right. Well, there we go. So let me ask you guys a question. How many of your grandchildren are smarter and better looking than any other grandchildren you've ever seen? Right? Okay. Yeah. All right. Exactly. Right. So why do we have those kind of feelings? Because when you look at a little human being, look at a baby, we know it's not just this jiggling pile of atoms. We know that it's special and designed by God. If significance were measured by size, whales would be the most important creatures on our planet. And I don't see anybody trying to make that argument. Any worldview or system that can't account for the inescapable weight and dignity and value of human beings ends up looking not intelligent by any sane rational evaluation. So, I mean, I guess you have to on your own decide what you think about that. But I just think it's inescapable. Any worldview that can't account for the dignity and value of human beings just comes up short by any rational evaluation. So number two, no. Science has not proven that the universe has no purpose. Number three, what is the apparently indistinguishable human desire for meaning, for purpose, to matter, tell us about human existence? Right? Because it's there, the desire to matter, to make a difference, to have a purpose. Here's another quote. It's a guy named Curtis White. He's not a believer. He's written this book called The Science Delusion. And it is debating this whole idea of scientism, that the scientific method can tell us everything there is to know about existence. So in his book, he quotes Jim Watson. Now, you may have heard of the name Watson and Crick, helped discover DNA, their work on their double helix. Watson was asked one time, what are human beings for? What's their purpose? And his argument was that they have no purpose. Jim Watson says, well, I don't think we are for anything. We're just products of evolution. Now notice it's not simply we're products. He says we're just products, nothing more. And Curtis White, in his book, he goes out to point out that while Jim Watson claimed that human life is nothing more than jiggling atoms, he does not seem to think that his accomplishments were nothing more than jiggling atoms. The story of how he fought and struggled, did a bunch of stuff to get the recognition of the Nobel Prize is really interesting. And White says, it's as if Jim Watson were saying, the earth is insignificant, people are transient, existence is random, life is meaningless, but I won the Nobel Prize. You know, Mom, you know, look at me. So the universe itself brings out a sense of wonder in us. And I know a lot of you connect with me this way. A few years ago, we had the opportunity to go down. We drove down to Disney World. We wanted to go there before Andy got too old. We wanted to be there one time. And one of the neatest things about going down there was my sister-in-law had a friend who helped, I don't know what that title, run SeaWorld. And so we were able to go to SeaWorld on one of the days we weren't going to Disney World and get sort of a backstage tour. Like when the park closed down, we came in with our kids and several other families with their kids and got to see all the animals, these wonderful, awesome, amazing animals, you know, after everybody had left. We had a behind-the-scenes tour. And the highlight of that at night, and if I remember this, is we went downstairs where they had a huge dolphin tank, and downstairs is the observation area. And so you go downstairs, and there's a window, probably as big as this wall, not up to the windows, probably that high, and it's just dolphins here. And we slept there. We all brought our backpacks, and it was lit up, and you just slept there, right in front of this huge wall. And you wake up at night, and like, they're there. And they would interact with you. You'd take a little ball or something, throw it, and they would come up to the wall and pretend to be bumping it back. And it was just this thing that just like filled you with awe and wonder that God created these creatures, and it was just awesome. Wonder is this realization, not only that something is, but that it's good. It's a human heart echoing the words that God spoke back in Genesis, that God spoke and saw that it was, you know, and it was so, and God saw that it was good. And I know some of you really hunger for wonder and meaning a clue to something just beyond material reality? C.S. Lewis wrote that he thinks it is. He said, creatures are not born with desires unless satisfaction for those desires exists. A baby feels hunger. Well, there's such a thing as food. A duckling wants to swim. Well, there's such a thing as water. Do people feel a sexual desire? There's such a thing as sex. He goes, if I am finding myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. All right, number four. Haven't science and religion always been at war with each other, offering rival explanations of the way things are? And this warfare view is a common one, is a classic example of this. In 1633, the Catholic Church found Galileo guilty of heresy, because he wrote and taught that the earth revolves around the sun rather than the other way around. That happened. And that kind of thing can happen. And sometimes we get into trouble if we assume too quickly that we understand the way that the Bible should be interpreted. Rather, when there's a place where God actually wants human beings to do scientific investigation. So you have these statements in the faith. This is from Psalm... Charlie, what Psalm are you reading out this morning? 103?
103.
Okay, never mind. Psalm 96. And it's also quoted in 1 Chronicles 16, that the earth is firmly established on its foundation, it cannot be moved. Well, there's some people that figured, well, we don't have to examine the world anymore, because that's what the Bible says, so everything else must revolve, you know, around the earth. And so sometimes we have to make sure that we're not inferring complete scientific knowledge based on those statements. But the notion that science and God have been historically at war with each other is a myth. In fact, historically, again, and we tend not to know this, science emerged primarily from people of faith. You know, in medieval Europe, it's kind of the cradle of science in many ways. There's a man named Rodney Stark, and he looked at studying the 52 leading scientists of the day and their thoughts and their actions. And he found out that 62% of them were what we call devout believers. 34% of them were conventionally religious. He said only 2 out of the 52 were religious skeptics. And of course, at that time, 17th century Europe, there was a fair number of skeptics, but only 2 of them, of the leading 52 scientists, were among them. Paul Chamberlain said it this way, said, the scientific enterprise as we know it probably would not exist if it had not been for Christianity. And many of you know, many of the first universities in the United States were Christian schools. And of course, then they would add science programs so they could discover more about the world that God had created. And it all started so in Hill theology. And again, this is not really widely known in our day because we've gotten away from history books and we get all of our information from, you know, Yahoo or Facebook or Twitter or commercials or movies. But there's so, and that helped engender this false idea in our day that belief in God actually got started out of our inability to understand things scientifically, right? It's false belief, that's where faith comes from. People didn't know where thunder came from, so they came up with the god Thor. Or people didn't know what governed the moon, so they made up the goddess Diana. People didn't know why anybody would choose to live in Michigan when they could have more jobs and a better climate anywhere else. All right, scientists still don't understand that one. But in the ancient world, they thought that the earth was involved in this endless cycle of existence. You know, things are going up and down, and the gods are fighting over things. The notion that the world is orderly and will reward rational investigation came a worldview that began with an all-powerful, rational God. One of the Nobel Prize winners said, this monotheistic view seems to be the historical foundation for modern science. Albert Whitehead, he said, when he was asked for the causes of the rise of science, when it came about, said, the medieval insistence on the rationality of God was what led to the rise of science. So, in answer to that one, no, science and faith have not always been at war with one another. Number five, hasn't evolution disproved Genesis? This has become a huge hot question topic, right? Evolution, really controversial thing. Little boy came to his dad one time and asked, Dad, where did human beings come from? said that we were descended from apes. She said, oh, well, I was talking about my side of the family. Just a word about Genesis and then a word about evolution. When you're studying the Bible, you always have to begin by asking, how are to be understood by the audience who was first written to? Because sometimes we just want to take things out of context in our arrogance and say, you know, well, things, I'm going to interpret it my way, the way I'm reading it now, in my situation. But Genesis 1 and 2 are primarily about how one true God is not like all these little tribal gods fighting back and forth and the forces of chaos. In the ancient world, they're not particularly concerned about how something got here from nothing. They're concerned about how order triumphed over chaos. And so that was a big thing that their story's about. So he writes primarily in Genesis about how one true God was initiated in the cosmos to come into a functioning temple. There's actually a lot of temple imagery in Genesis 1 and 2, where God would take up residence and then kind of deploy out his image bearers. That's all human beings made in God's image to extend his reign, take dominion, so all the earth could be ordered and become a sacred place where God could dwell with his community. Now, of course, in our day, and this is a hot button topic in churches, people interpret Genesis 1 and 2 differently. But I believe the best reading of it, just on biblical terms, is not about, you know, how long, you know, or the role of mutation or what they call natural selection. You know, those questions weren't about around that for the people, the audience. Genesis is addressing questions in ways that have laid out the identity of human beings and our place in the universe. So it can be a very legitimate place for science to explore all kinds of questions of how and how long. And sometimes we get in churches and we might use quasi-science or bad science and we teach it to our young people and then they go off to school and they say, well, no, now science says this is different and now I have to choose between science and my faith and science and what I was taught in church. And sometimes it's because they're being misinformed in the first place. And so sometimes churches mess that up. And on the other hand, we have secularists will misuse the language of theory of evolution to make claims about the human identity that are false and destructive. For example, a few years ago, there was a study that said that chimps share 99.4% of DNA with human beings. One researcher said, we humans appear as only slightly remodeled chimpanzee-like apes. Only slightly remodeled. And one guy writing about this actually entitled his book, The Third Chimpanzee. There's two species of chimps, and essentially implying that based on the percentage of shared DNA, the human beings are simply a third species of chimps. There's not really much difference between human beings and chimps. And if you really believe yourself, or you wonder if that's really true, ask yourself if you have a chimpanzee babysit one of your children. Ask yourself if you would elect a chimpanzee to Congress. I was really waiting for you to make up your mind. Would you date one? Would you put a chimpanzee on trial for ethical breach and hold them morally accountable for their behavior? No, because human identity, human condition, the human word, who we are just huge questions. And they're not going to be answered by analysis of shared percentage of DNA with other creatures. The Bible says that we are, and that you are, an unceasing spiritual being with eternal destiny in God's great universe. And now you have to decide, is that true? Or are you a third chimpanzee? And I understand that there's really bright people who struggle with this, and I'm not trying to demean anybody, but those two decisions are ways of thinking are going to lead down two very different paths. No, evolution has not disproved Genesis. And number six, and again, there's a lot more that can be said on all of these things, but I'm just trying to hit them quickly. Doesn't the Big Bang show that the universe didn't need God to create it? Right? A lot of you probably heard of that, and I'm not talking about the television show that's out right now. But you've heard about the idea of the Big Bang, the universe had a beginning, right? And really, it's interesting stuff, because 100 years ago, that was never a question that the scientists were wrestling with. Scientists just always assumed the universe always was, always is, always was. And they didn't think there was a beginning to it. They thought matter and space had always been around. And so now they just get kind of discovered, oh, it looks like the universe had a beginning, so now we've got to come up with a way to explain it, right? That doesn't involve God. So scientists now believe the universe, I'm just saying, I'm just reporting from scientists, the universe is about 13.798 billion years old. Has begun with something that's commonly called as the Big Bang. And this astounding notion of a single point of whatever that everything comes out of. And it's wild when you read about it. Scientists have tried to come to grips over the last century that there's a beginning to the universe. The astrophysicist Robert Jastrow wrote this. At this moment, it seems as though science will never be able to raise the curtain on the mystery of creation. For the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountains of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. That little phrase at the beginning of your Bible, in the beginning, starts to take on a whole different meaning than it did two centuries ago. It's even more staggering than that is the existence of the Big Bang itself. It's the fact that the universe appears in the strangest way to be designed to support life. This is sometimes called the anthropic principle. It's talked about a lot of people in cosmology and physics. Anthropos. It's a Greek word for man, right? We talk about anthropology. The universe seems strangely fine-tuned for life in a bunch of ways. I'm just going to tell you one. And I'm going to read it because I don't understand it completely, but about a millisecond after the Big Bang, the universe cooled down enough for what is called quarks and anti-quarks to condense out of that. Boom. And the way it worked out, as I understand it, as I use scientific words like boom, that any quark encountering an anti-quark would result in complete annihilation of them both and a release of a little photon of energy. That's all that was left, just annihilation. But as it turns out, there's not an equal number of quarks and anti-quarks, but it turns out the symmetry that you actually expect between the two was off by the tiniest bit that nobody could have predicted. So about out of every billion anti-quarks, there's one leftover lonely quark. Now, why there's an asymmetry there, nobody has any idea, at least in science. But it turns out that if there had been an equal number of quarks and anti-quarks, they just annihilate each other, there'd be no universe. So it turns out that this one in a billion lonely quarks made it possible for there to be galaxies and stars and planets, and oh, by the way, you. So in terms of the person near you, just say, you're one in a billion, because literally you are. You're one in a billion. And it's not just that. It turns out to be there's like 15 different constants. You have to imagine across the screen here, or across the front here, you know, you've got these little panels. Well, imagine they go all the way across. Imagine there's 15 of them. Imagine this is a big dial. Each one of them is a big dial. It doesn't just have like 10 settings. It has like 10,000 settings on the dial. Okay? And so there's 15 different constants, like the precise force of gravity. If it was altered enough, just so you weigh like a hundredth of a pound more or less one way or the other, the universe in your life could not exist. It's exactly what it needed to be. There's 15 different constants like that whose values have to be exactly what they are for the universe to support life. And by the way, that turns out to be exactly what they are. You know, we think of things like astronomical odds. You know, what was it recently? The NCAA tournament, the billion-dollar bracket. You know, you have 1 in 1 trillion chance. You basically have to win that billion-dollar bracket like a billion times in a row to equal the chance that all of these things, all the constants of the universe would be what they are to be able to support life. Well, it takes so much more, as we're talking to the kids about faith, it takes so much more faith to believe that this is all by accident. And you probably know the name Stephen Hawking. He's not a person of faith. He's a physicist a lot of you have heard of. He wrote, "It would be very difficult to explain why the universe should have begun the way it did, except as the act of a God who intended to create beings like us." Now, that's a remarkable statement because Stephen Hawking doesn't believe in a God like that. But to deal with this, with all the constants and everything being perfect, this is the theory that they come up with. Because what you end up having to believe in is you don't believe in a God, because our universe is so improbable. It's what's called a multiverse. Anybody ever heard that phrase of a multiverse. Basically, that there are thousands and millions of other universes out there that we can't see. And you think this? You think I'm talking crazy? This is one of the best theories out there from scientists of how we got this our universe. There's millions of other universes out there we can't detect. It just turns out, as a random throw of the dice, there happens to be this one universe that we live in that's livable. So I guess to put it mildly, the notion that there are multiple universes is not, that has not been proven by any scientific method. Another Nobel-winning scientist who co-discovered cosmic radiation helped support this notion of the Big Bang in the first place. He wrote, "The best data we have from science are exactly what I would have predicted had I had nothing to go on but the first, but the five books of Moses, the Psalms, and the Bible as a whole." So has science proven that faith is irrational and God doesn't exist? Well, if you're going to think about that more on your own, maybe you need to do more reading about it. But I would say no, not by a long shot. And just personally, even just thinking and reading and researching about this stuff gives me more of a sense of awe and wonder about a God that could do this. And it can be so hard for scientists, for people of faith, because you can get ridiculed for it. And you're teaching it in schools or in colleges. The peers of people like that really get ridiculed hard. And there's this misguided notion that some people are secularists or scientists are open to truth, you know, and wherever it leads. And to be in faith is about being in a community where you can't listen to reason because you have to listen to whatever's written down in the book because it was written down in the book sometime. And that's not true. The Bible is not coming into existence that way, and it's got part of a great thoughtful conversation that went along with a lot of people that were very thoughtful, and of course the Holy Spirit inspiring all of that. Here's the last. And Jesus will be the first person to tell us to follow, relentlessly follow truth wherever it leads. You know, that I know that's what they want, you know, to be able to. I'm going to diverge here for a second. Several years ago, I don't know, 15 years ago, Amy was teaching science over in Ballardville. And so I saw on the periodicals, like they send out the newsletters, you know, science teacher newsletters. And I was reading it and talked to them about the teachers, like about evolution and how we can't, you know, we know there's stuff wrong with this, we know there's holes, but we have to keep teaching this because you know what the alternative is. You know, if we say that there's holes in it, you know, then people are going to follow truth where it leads. And that can be so hard. I guess she's been gone there far enough that I can say this out loud. Are we recording? Okay, well, whatever. So anyway, what she would do was she would have the kids in the class. She wouldn't teach it, but she'd let them debate. Okay, this person talked about creation, and this person, you know, argued for evolution and let them debate it and let truth lead where it goes. Last quote from C.S. Lewis: "God is no fonder of intellectual slackers than of any other slackers." You know, sometimes we get our information from the Bible. We need to get our information from the Bible and from those that have studied it, and not just greeting cards and movies and Yahoo and Facebook and what it says on the, you know, the Google Science site or whatever. In becoming a Christian, we're embarking on something which is going to take all of us, brains and all. So we want to have all of us together on this journey. Yeah, we have faith, but we don't have blind faith. Let's stop right there. Let's pray. I just want to read to you someone who wrote.